everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Writer's Process Podcast. Please welcome my guest, John Ward. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. So I wanted to ask, like, from the very beginning, did you always want to be a writer?
Writer and director. Yes, I wanted to do both. Yeah.
So, like, which one came first of everything? The writing, and then you decided you wanted to direct, or did you direct something before you got a chance to write anything?
I'd probably say director came first. Okay. And then I wanted control, and then so I wanted to write too.
You're just like me. that's why I got it. Like, I was telling, who was I telling that to? Was I telling it to you guys yesterday? I'm trying to remember because we did a podcast yesterday with you, and I'm trying to remember because my thing is I like control, so that's why I became, like, originally I liked to write, and then I became a, no, it was this guy I got interviewed today by, but I liked control of everything. So I'm just like you. I like when I write, I like to be able to direct it, and then I like to produce, because that's the way you can make sure that your vision from your directing gets done. You know, otherwise I really don't like producing, you know, it's my least favorite, you know. What is your,
I tend to do a little bit of everything, cause I'm kind of a control freak. So not a horrible control freak, but I'm since I've worked retail my whole life, it's one of those whole things of, if you want to do it right, you do it yourself. Mm-hmm. So I feel that even if I handed a project over to somebody to produce, or if I handed it over to them to direct, I'm sorry, not direct, but edit, or even write, I would still be part of it. Right. I would still be in there. So I might as well be the main guy who's doing it all.
Exactly.
And you know, and still be able to pick the people out to produce it and edit it, and if I wanted to go off of somebody else's script, you know, they would still be there, but I would be there too.
Yeah, no, totally. So you've done, like, movies, like you did in the Axemas movies, right? Like, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, Axemas and Axemas 2 Bloodslay, they're both around 30 minutes. They're both available from Scream Time Films. Really cool DVDs.
On, like, one DVD or their own DVD?
They're on their own DVDs. Axemas has a whole bunch of extras on it, and there were so many extras for Axemas 2 that we had to put it on two different DVDs.
Nice.
So it's actually a double disc. Yeah.
Sweet.
So it's, but it's, they actually came up, I would probably say in the early 90s is when I first came up with the idea.
Sweet.
Yeah, and just never did anything with it until, you know, a few years ago.
Okay, and so you came up with it in the 90s. What was the inspiration?
I just came up with the title Axemas. This is early 90s, so it was really before the internet was huge. Like, it was still dial-up and all that type of stuff. So I don't think I stole it from anything. I don't think I saw something and said, oh, this would make a great title for a horror film. I think I just thought, oh, Axemas, that'd be a cool title. I could be wrong, but I just thought this would make a great horror film, and then never did anything with the title. And it wasn't until I moved up north to the Bay Area, where I was going to school again, and then started to fiddle around with the idea a little bit more and did some test footage for a completely different Axemas movie. And I still have that footage. That footage is now, God, like 20 years old, it has to be. And then when I was working at the storage facility, that's when it all happened. That's when it all came together.
Nice. I had an idea, like a title like yours, but it was, instead of Axemas, and it wasn't a horror, it was going to be a comedy, like a romantic comedy, about a guy getting back with his ex on Christmas. So it was going to be Xmas. You know? And everything, but like...
E-X-miss.
E-X-M-I-S-S, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think. Because now I'm getting kind of confused because there's another guy I knew that had a similar story thing, like, or at least with the title, you know, but it was a completely different, it was like a bunch of exes getting together for Christmas, you know, but so it was similar in the title. So I'm trying to remember if mine had, I think mine might've just been X and then MAS, you know, like Xmas, like that. I don't know. Something like that.
Okay.
Anyway, the point is that I was just like you, I had the pun of having something with Xmas, you know, being the you know, for Christmas. But mine wasn't. I love you know, holiday slasher movies, you know, like I'm sure you're a big fan of Black Christmas, I'm sure, and things like that.
Yeah, the original Black Christmas. My favorite one, of course, being Silent Night, Deadly Night, because that was one of the inspirations for Xmas. So
not Silent Night, Deadly Night Part 2.
And part two, yes, actually, Xmas 4 will be a clip movie in tribute to Silent Night, Deadly Night Part 2.
Well, I think what's the worst part about that is like they only have like maybe 20 minutes in the actual like real movie. It feels like a Charles Band put together like Puppet Master thing, you know, or something where they just kind of threw everything together instead of old clips and just like, let's just make, we only have enough money for like a short, but we can make a whole movie out of the last movie that you watched.
Well, with part two is it was originally because they removed the first film from the theaters, is the studio hired the director, Lee Henry, and said, we want you to remake the movie.
Right.
So the idea was that the original Silent Night, Deadly Night never existed, like literally never existed. And then they were going to bring it out as Silent Night, Deadly Night again, but have Eric Freeman and the psychiatrist, and then he'd do the flashbacks, and that would replace the original film.
Oh, and then the movie came out. Both those movies came out at the same time, right? Is that what you're saying?
Well, no, it was a few years later. And then but the director said, well, give me some extra money and we'll just do a sequel to it.
Okay.
And so that's kind of, so it originally started off with, we're basically just going to get rid of Silent Night, Deadly Night because it offended so many people. We'll remake it with some new footage. But the director's like, give me more money and I'll film more footage and we'll just release it as a sequel. So there is a whole history behind it. I remember when I originally saw it, I hated it.
Because
mm-hmm. I'm like, what is this? This is so cheap. Why would you do this? But there's a history behind the film and why it is the
so
way that it is.
So now you respect it a little bit more. You know,
I love it. Yeah.
Well,
and I also like part three. I'm one of the few people I think who likes part three.
How many did they make? They made like six of them, right? Or something.
There's five plus the remake. So six. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. See, I know these things randomly, like in my brain, but I've never, like, I've only seen the first two. Like, I haven't watched the other ones. I'm into the original Black Christmas, but I'm not into a lot of the Christmas. Like, I watched Christmas Evil when I was younger, you know, but I never really, you know, like, it was never something, I was never into Santa Claus killing people, you know, like, it just, or somebody dressed up like Santa Claus killing people generally. Now, I do want to see Xmas at some point, and I know that Scream Time, who puts it out, Cook, you know, Todd Jason Cook, right?
Does, yes.
Puts that out. He does, like, sales, you know, all the time. And eventually when I get a job and get everything, I'm going to try to get them. You know, try to get some of those movies. And I am going to get yours as well because, I love to support indie artists. And B, I've been wanting to see it for a while. So, and
I appreciate that. I can see about setting you up. So I think that they're really good DVDs. We really put a lot of work into them. I mean, because it's a short film, I made sure that, that people got their money's worth.
Right.
And it just depends, you know, like the, Part two has five audio commentaries.
Oh,
so you watch the film, then you watch five audio commentaries.
There used to be a lot of people who did that. Like Chris Seaver used to do a lot of commentary tracks, like three or four, you know, commentary tracks. And I love that. And now all of a sudden, like, even Chris Seaver doesn't do commentary tracks anymore. So I'm always shocked by that, you know, that people just stop doing that because, like, if you're, especially if you do a short, You know, you need something extra. You need more stuff, because otherwise, you know, like paying $15 or whatever, sometimes 10, you know, on a movie is still a lot for a short film, you know?
Right. And it was actually pointed out to me by Lindsay Cruz, who's in Axiomus One. I met up with her the other day, and she's amazed at how Axiomus, being a short film, has had the life that it's had. I mean, mm-hmm. most short films just kind of disappear, and Axiomus is actually kind of out there like a feature film.
Yeah, that's really cool. So after were the Axiomus movies your first ones? Or what did you do before then?
I basically, for a long time, I wasn't doing anything. And then David Sterling asked me if I wanted to work on this film up in Tonopah at the Clown Motel, the actual Clown Motel with the cemetery next to it and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And that's where I met Philip Trickey. And I ended up going up there to make a film, which we had to change the title because of the other Clown Motel. So ours is Clown Motel Massacre.
Is that the Is that the one with my friend Morgan in it?
It has Julie Prescott in it.
Because my friend Morgan acted in a clown hotel movie. That wasn't the one that got like the Spirits Away that Joseph Kelly did. I think she was. I think. Morgan.
That's the reason why we had to change the title, was because of the Joseph Kelly one.
Yeah, which, I mean, it's kind of interesting that you guys both made the same, or not same movie, but like a similar, you know, thing. And then I guess, you know, you guys had to change the title for it. Yeah, she was in Clown Motel Massacre. She was in, she would play Taylor on it. Taylor Henderson.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I know her. Yeah.
That's Morgan.
The Morgan who you're talking about. Okay. Yeah, okay.
She was my co-host for a while for my radio show and stuff, you know.
Oh, yeah. I like Morgan. Yeah.
Yeah, she's a sweetheart.
She did a good job in the film. So I wanted to work with her again. Actually, I wanted to work with a few of the cast members again, but it just never happened. So, but well, it was not an easy shoot. So it was. But I learned a lot, I mean, of just how indie films are made. Like, you realize that with three crew people and five casts, you can make a feature film in, you know, 4 or 5 days. So, you know.
Yeah. Well, if you can do that, that's awesome. Because, you know, like, I don't know. I've shot, like, short films or promos or whatever. And even if we shoot, like, for 4 days or something, we only get like 20 minutes, you know, because it's just, there's so much like, it's hard sometimes when you have a crew that you have to make sure, you know, like this shot is done and then it takes, you know what I mean? Like, it's really hard to do a guerrilla style sometimes, depending on where you're at and everything.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it was definitely a learning experience, because I was just supposed to go up as a PA. And one day I got a call from the director and from Philip at different times saying, hey, the guy who ended up playing the killer clown in it, he can't make it. So you're now the killer clown. So I went from a PA to basically the Freddy Krueger of the movie. And wow. I'm on the poster and all that. Yes. Yes, it was. And that was interesting, because it's some days I worked crew and some days I was the clown. And, after that, when I was working at the storage facility, I met a guy named John Seymour, and he was making a film called Drug Z, which is where I met all of the, you know, all the Axiomus people on.
Oh,
and
nice.
We got talking, and that was even smaller crew and smaller budget. And that's the film where I really said, you can make a movie literally with three crew people and like five actors or less. And
if you can, go for it.
Yeah. And then that's where Axiomus came in, is I just kind of rounded up the people who were in Drug Z. And Axiomus originally started off just as a slasher film, just as a guy who's living inside a storage unit and he's killing the tenants. And that was right. boring. It was just dull. There was nothing interesting about it. And then I figured, well, wait, I have this title called Axiomus that I've never used. And once that came in and I put in the Christmas thing, it was just a free for all. I could write whatever I wanted to. And, and it worked out really well. So it's as far as like a writer goes. I mean, when you have that freedom to do whatever you want, you know, once it clicks, it's great.
Yeah. Well, good for you, dude. That's awesome.
Well, thank you.
Now let's start. So after Axiomus, what, at least the first one, what did you end up doing after that?
Then Axiomus 2. A couple of the crew people didn't come back. John didn't want to come back, who played the John Seymour. He was the Killer Santa. He didn't want to come back again, but his character was dead. So that'd be a little difficult anyways. Yeah, so then Drew Marvick came in, and I made it a family. Oh. And so it's a family that's obsessed with Christmas, and this is what they do, is that for Christmas they kill people. That's like their thing. And but they're taking revenge on Sarah, who's played by Ashley Campbell, because she survives the first movie, so she comes back to the second movie, and they bring her back to the same storage facility. And then they start torturing her again, and there's a whole bunch of new victims. And like I said, Drew Marvick is the who did a Pool Party Massacre. He's the Killer Santa.
Man, I still want to see that too. Is that on Prime, I wonder? Like,
I would think so. I mean, he has it on a ton of streaming sites and VHS, DVD, and all that. It's a really fun film, and he's a local filmmaker. And then we got like Tommy Vegas to be in part two, and Ben Stober, and we got a bunch of people that I was happy with.
I think he was at Texas Frightmare last year, and I knew he was there, and we were supposed to meet up or something or whatever, but unfortunately we didn't, I think, if I'm correct, because I know he was promoting, you know, Pool Party and all the other stuff that he's doing, I believe. So I don't know.
Yeah, he's a really nice guy, and he'll talk to anybody. So it's, if you missed him that one time, as I'm sure he'll talk, you know, to you.
I was going to say, you're like, he'll talk to anybody. I was like, what are you trying to say here? You know?
No, he's just a really nice guy. So that's the whole thing.
Okay,
and,
good.
But a lot of those people came from a film called Scare Me that I was working on, which is Mark Stevens and Thomas Fisco. When I was working on that, that's where I met like Mark Justice, Tommy Vegas, and a few other people who were all at Axiomus too.
Nice.
So as a filmmaker, the more movies you work on, that's your auditions.
Right.
So I've literally never held an audition. I just work on a bunch of movies. If I like the person, I ask them to be in one of my films.
I don't audition either, generally speaking. I've done a couple auditions. No, I don't generally like it because, like, I usually have ideas of who I want in my head already or something. You know, or I just contact my friends who I think could probably do a pretty good job, you know, portraying whatever I'm like thinking of, you know, at that time. So, I mean, that's kind of how I work. But as far as, you know, you getting auditions, or not auditions, but like telling, you know, becoming friends with the people, it seems the same way, you know, like you just meet people and you're like, hey, you'd be good for this movie.
Well, yeah, and that's the whole thing with Tommy Vegas was, I didn't know that she was in like Party Night and Another Evil Night and stuff. I just saw that she did some line readings really well, like really kind of bitchy, and I liked that. And then they covered her in blood, and I'm like, oh, this is perfect. And I got along with her. And then when I wrote Axiomus 2, is I thought I really want Tommy to be in this. And it was through all that we got along on the set. She's willing to have like a gallon of blood thrown on her. She did line readings really well, got along with everybody. Let's bring her on for Axiomus 2. So that's, you know, how that went.
She's also worked with Neil Breen, by the way. So I've always
very nice.
I've always wanted to talk to her about that, you know, experience, because God, have you ever seen his movies?
I haven't seen his films all the way through. I do need
to. You've tried watching them, and then?
Yeah, because, you know, you find them on online or they're streaming or whatever, and sometimes I just can't get through it. But
really?
You almost
are
need
streaming, because like Paul and I do, you know, the Indie Film Cafe, and we've which you've been on, so you know, but we've done 2 Neil Breen movies so far in the 3 seasons that we have, right? So there'll probably be one more Neil Breen movie this year, most likely. And they always get a 10, 10, 10. They've always get 30s. Like, so far they've been like, you know, the head thing. But he's had to buy them, like I think from Neil, you know, basically, like through his website.
I wouldn't doubt that. Yeah. I mean, and he's smart for doing that, I think. So
I would love to interview him, but like I think he's afraid of interviews and stuff, of people asking. Like, I would treat it like he was Steven Spielberg, you know? Like, I'd be asking him real questions and stuff and trying to get real answers. You know, but he's kind of like Tommy Wiseau. I don't think, like, he kind of views himself as like this really good artist, you know, in a way, or whatever. Maybe he's worse than Tommy, because at least Tommy knows to joke on himself. Neil doesn't seem to have that kind of sense of humor.
I am one of the few people who did not like The Room.
Nobody likes The Room.
Well, I should say I did not like The Room for being a bad movie. I thought it was just a bad movie. And I only watched it and sat through the whole thing because then I was going to go see The Disaster Artist.
Good.
That's a great movie.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, I'm a Birdemic guy. I'll take Birdemic any day over The Room. I mean, if
we did that for season one, we did Birdemic. Ugh, that movie is so
I love Birdemic. I've seen it many times.
I own it on Blu-ray.
So do I.
Yeah, you know, I got it. Like, I think Brad Twigg was selling it or something. Somebody was selling it at a convention. I was like, dude, I'm not gonna, like, I think Paul was almost gonna buy it, but he's like one of those guys that like he doesn't buy bad movies on Blu-ray, only good movies, you know, like he doesn't want to waste his money on but I think he would have bought Birdemic on Blu-ray just because that's just so bad, you know.
But I was at Best Buy and it was in their $5 Blu-ray bin.
Nice.
And I grabbed it. I think I like went through the entire thing to grab it because I saw it way down there, and I think I held it up and I'm like, yes, I have Birdemic on Blu-ray.
Yeah,
I was so proud of that. So, and then the sequel came out. And it was like, okay, you know.
Well, it's because like it's like, okay, so Tommy Wiseau did The Room. Then he realized everybody was laughing at it, not like, you know, not, you know what I mean, not taking it seriously. So then he went and tried to do a movie or a TV show for Hulu, which he did. He put there. I don't know if you remember that, but there was a TV show called Neighbors that he.
Yes, it's horrible. Yes.
Oh, it's terrible because he's trying so hard to be funny. Then, you know?
That's the problem, and that's the problem with Birdemic too.
Exactly.
He's very self-aware, and that kind of ruins things. Once you become self-aware.
Neil Breen is not self-aware at all. He thinks he makes the most amazing movies. So
correct.
I mean, I would love to crack his brain open and just see like like what makes him think he's like so amazing. I don't know, but see, he's a Las Vegas guy, so we're kind of disappointed. Or I didn't even think about it that we should have. Paul and I should have gone to some of the sites from you know, when we went to visit, when we saw you and met you and everything. We should have went there and visited like there's a school, you know, Las Vegas school that they shot at and stuff.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So should have done that, but you know, we didn't. No. Oh, well. Huh. Well, I mean, I live 3 hours away from Las Vegas now, so there's no reason.
Oh, more you drive out here, the easier it is. So it takes me roughly 3.5-4 hours to get to LA, and it's just, it's nothing. These days it's nothing.
Yeah. So, I mean, eventually I'll probably go back to it. Well, I know I want to go for like one of the, I think there's Days of the Dead convention that Julie, you know.
Julie and her husband put on.
So I think I want to eventually, I think that's supposed to be in September. So if I can go up there in September, that'd be awesome. I mean, even if it's just for a day, you know, like a Saturday or something, go up there and see everybody and then go home the next day.
Right.
That'll be worth it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, true, true.
But anyway, let's talk a little bit more like about so you ended up doing after Axmas 2, what did you end up doing like after that? What was your next
then project? That was Meat Hook Massacre 4.
And is that available for people to see or
it is you would have to see it streaming through Dustin Ferguson's through his streaming,
okay.
I don't know, streaming site, streaming. Yeah. I don't know exactly how you would say it, but it's a, yeah, it's. I believe it's double featured with Meat Hook Massacre 5. So you would, yeah. So you would have to get a subscription, and then you could watch it there. Eventually, hopefully, it will come out. I've heard it's supposed to come out through Wild Eye Releasing.
Okay.
That was the original deal, was that it was supposed to come out on on DVD, and it hasn't. So, well,
I mean, as much as I love Wild Eye to death, you know, because I give them props for giving like a lot of indie filmmakers, you know, this like, you know, glorious chance. Like, I think they put out a lot of really goofy movies that I couldn't, you know, like I'm so excited, Clownado and all these films, but then also I think they get too much stuff, you know, people give, you know, send them a lot of stuff, so they end up getting backlogged and they have to put them out when they can, because they can only put out like one a month or something, you know, or whatever.
Right. Yeah, well, hopefully that will come out, and I've called Meat Hook Massacre 4 my apocalypse now. So if I had to, and I'm not saying my films are on these levels at all, but if I had to compare them to Coppola, I'd probably say Axmas would be Godfather, Axmas 2 would be Godfather 2, and then, because I think Godfather 2 is better than Godfather 1, and Meat Hook is my apocalypse now, which was, you know, which was Coppola's nightmare.
What about your Godfather 3? Have you made that yet?
No, and I hope not. So
Godfather 3 is the worst.
I can watch it. It's just not that great of a movie.
Yeah,
it's
boring.
But I own it. I mean, I have it because I have the other two,
it's funny. I have the other two, but I will not own the third one.
One was part of a package. So, you know, you got all three films in one package. So,
well, it's kind of like, to me, it's kind of like Scream. You know, I have Scream 1, Scream 2, and Scream 4, and I don't have Scream 3, and that's because I'm bitter against Scream 3. I really, like, I have a love-hate relationship with it, so.
I'm in the same boat. I am not happy with Scream 3 at all. I don't know what was going on with Courtney Cox's hair.
A lot of it had to do with the fact, a lot of the movie itself had to do with the fact that, I guess Kevin Williamson was burnt out at that time doing too much stuff that he just didn't. He gave the storyline that he wanted, and the Ring writer, Reindeer Games writer, Ewan Kruger ended up writing the rest of it. So it had its moments where I'm like, this could be a decent movie, but all in all, I felt like it was a ripoff of Scream instead of being an actual Scream movie. You know.
Yeah, when you have Kevin Smith in there, you know.
That's only best part of the movie is Jay and Silent Bob's like.
I hated that. I hated that. So it's I can't stand that. To me, it's because Axmas is it's Silent Night, Deadly Night, and Scream. Those were the two films that inspired it.
Right.
And so to me, Scream 3 was just insulting to the other two movies that were done, I thought, so well.
Yeah, it was really funny because I guess when Scream 3 came out in 2000, and then Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back came out in 2001, I think, right? Like right after. So they basically have that scene where there is another Scream movie, but Shannon Doherty is taking off the mask to reveal like the monkey. Remember?
Oh yeah.
In Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back. And I just think that's really funny because, like, I think it was a way for Kevin to kind of give something back to Wes for doing that for him, which I thought was pretty cool. Because I like Kevin Williamson, I love Kevin Smith. Those are my two of my favorite writers of all time, and Quentin Tarantino. So three people, but those two Kevins have kind of inspired me, you know, or whatever, you know, like in a way. So in some way or another.
That's cool.
Yeah. But and a lot of people know that. I mean, if you watch my writing's not like a ripoff of theirs or anything, but I do love dialogue. I'm not a big pulp culture guy, you know, like I don't make references like that or anything, but you know, I do like comedy in my horror, you know, and stuff. So do you like comedy in your horror?
It depends on what type of comedy it is. I don't like flat out horror comedy, but
right,
like it's
a scary movie, you know.
Like I actually don't like the scary movies at all, because Scream is a spoof. It's a dark comedy.
Right.
And so it's in its own way, it is a comedy. So to make Scary Movie to me was stupid. It was pointless. But it depends. I mean, it just matters what the humor is. Right. I mean, it's okay to, you know, Freddy Krueger's humor at the beginning was good, and then it just got stupid at the end.
Oh, are you talking about in the first movie?
Like the first Nightmare on Elm Street, his humor in it was really funny, kind of like sick humor.
He didn't really have that much humor in the first one, did he?
I was like cutting off his fingers, and he's like, you know, I'm your boyfriend now. And, you know, he's doing these little things in there that make you laugh, but they're creepy, you know, type of thing.
Did he lick her through the phone on the first
one? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's where he says, I'm your boyfriend now. And then the tongue comes out. And then part three, the humor was still good. It was still okay. And then by the time that we got to like, you know, the final Friday, it just became stupid.
No, part four was silly and stupid. Like
part four is actually my favorite one. Part four is my favorite.
Well, I was telling the guy that I was getting interviewed by today that Leonard Maltin had that book, right? I don't know if you remember this or not, but there's like a big book of like reviews that Leonard Maltin did, and he would give like five-star ratings or whatever, or a bomb. And he gave, I remember specifically, he gave Nightmare on Elm Street 4 a bomb, right? And said that you know that movie's going to be bad when it starts with the dog urinating and fire.
That's brilliant. That was great.
But for like an old
it's the devil dog.
He's not into horror, I'm sure, you know, like.
Oh, see, to me, that's just great. And it's beautifully shot and it's beautifully edited. And it's
hilarious.
It's like, well directed. And the very beginning of it says Robert Englund in. I mean, so we all knew, you know, like they knew what we were going to see. To me, it's the pentacle of Nightmare on Elm Street films. Like they reached that height. And they could only go down from part four.
That's true. Though I did like part five a lot. Like
five is good. It just was rushed, and you could kind of tell.
And I know we just talked about today also how I like. I don't know. I think so. Halloween 4. I like Halloween 5 is like my least favorite Halloween, and I'll go on record and say that. Like I'm just not a fan of the fifth one. I love the fourth one. You know, and I love Danielle Harris as, you know, Jamie Lloyd, but I was not a fan of the was it Michael Myers Revenge or Return?
Yeah, the Revenge of Michael Myers. Yeah, yeah.
Revenge of Michael Myers. It was just awful to me, you know.
Well, it had a bad director, and it was rushed. It was just like Nightmare on Elm Street 5. They rushed it. They should have waited 2 years instead of 1 year.
Yeah. And that's exactly right. And I feel like a lot of times that's what they do with horror film sequels. You know, they're like, oh man, we need to get the next one out there as soon as possible. Instead of thinking like, you know, can we take some time to actually get a good writer or something? Nightmare on Elm Street 4 had Brian Helgeland, who went on to,
right.
to do like Knight's Tale and The Order and a bunch of other great movies and write. I mean, he's an amazing writer, one of my favorites. And he, I mean, yeah, I agree. Like, I love the dog peeing and all of a sudden you see the fire come out and shit. And you see Freddy come back, you know, to life from being resurrected by dog urine. That's funny to me. But it's also works for Nightmare on Elm Street.
You know? Well, yeah, and the film is very bright when you compare it to the other films. It has very kind of Christmassy colors because of his sweater in it. It's a very bright movie. Not a lot of it is in the dark. So you really get to see Freddy a lot. It's different from the other Nightmare films, which is what I like.
Now, like... So what else did I, because I talked to him about a couple of things. And see, I like talking to you about this stuff because you and I are on the same, I think we're on the same kind of level. But you're probably going to disagree with my favorite Friday the 13th film, you know. What do you think, like, would be my favorite if, after all the things I've told you already about me, you know, you kind of know about me, what would you guess?
Part 8?
Ah, yes, congratulations, that's awesome. Yes, that is my favorite, Jason Takes Manhattan, which, you know, a lot of people don't like, a lot of people, but I love it, and I've told Kane before that's my favorite Friday the 13th, like, and he actually says he really enjoyed it, you know, working on it and everything, you know.
I enjoyed it, I can always watch it, but it would not be in my, if I had to do a top five, I don't think it may not be in there.
I would guess out of knowing you, and I might be wrong, but I would say either 4 or 6 is your favorite.
Oh no, 7.
7. Oh, good. That's a good one.
No, yeah. Kane, it's, I think the best that Kane has been, Jason looks the best. It mm-hmm. has a more kind of Hammer feel to it, a more gothic feel. And it's more raw feeling. So 7 would be my favorite. And then after that would be 6.
Yeah, 6 is almost a little bit compared with the gothic kind of Frankenstein feel to the, you know, like the, he gets resurrected by lightning, you know, and all that stuff. It felt like they were trying to go through, do a throwback, but also it had a little tongue in cheek and was kind of silly and fun.
Well, there's where the humor works. That works because it has a good director who's also the writer, and he knows humor. Uh-huh. So all that stuff was funny. It worked for the movie. Even when they broke the fourth wall and the gravedigger just looks straight into the camera and talks to the camera, it's funny. It works.
Yeah.
So it's just, it all depends on, to kind of go back to your horror question with comedy. It depends on who does it and how it's done.
Exactly. I agree. Cause I like to watch movies that have comedy in it. Like I think that's why I was drawn to Friday the 13th part 8. I think there was a lot of things. It was like one of the first Friday the 13th films I'd ever seen, you know, because at that time, I think it was 1988. I think, or something. I would have been 6 years old, right? So it was coming on like 88 to 90. It was coming on USA all the time because USA used to play all the Friday the 13th movies. And I would see it and I would see the cut edited version or whatever. Like you wouldn't see the scene where the guy takes the boat spear or whatever or Jason takes the boat spear and shoves it into the guy's crotch or whatever and pulls out his balls, you know, you don't remember
that. The spear gun.
Yeah, the spear gun.
Yeah.
That was one of the best scenes in the movie, but you didn't see that on USA, you know, or whatever. They probably cut away to that or whatever. I never remembered it until saw it years later on VHS or something, and I was like, oh my goodness, this is not what I remember, but that's awesome, you know? Like,
no, that part 4 is a well-written Friday film, so
that was 8.
Part 4 would probably be...
8 had the spear gun on the boat, because they were taking the cruise to Manhattan or whatever on the...
Well, I'm thinking part 4 when he uses the spear gun on the guy's balls when he lifts him out of the water.
That's true. He does that. Jesus, what is up with Jason and spear guns? And balls.
Well, and he uses a spear gun in part three, because that's how, you know, he gets the girl in the eye.
Oh, sorry. Goodness gracious. Oh, my goodness.
So that's his second favorite weapon of choice, I guess.
But his first would be machete, which is like... That's like the thing everybody always, like, you know, and if you think about it, he doesn't use machete as much as, like, people think he does, you know? Like, he uses
mostly
whatever.
Walks with it. Yeah, but the kind of whatever is around him, but he walks a lot with machetes.
Well, also, he, you know, the first, like, big thing was part three, right, where he gets the mask and everything. And in that movie, there was that barn or whatever, and that's where he probably picked up the machete. I just don't remember, like, where he first got it, you know. But
he got it from part two.
Did he? Because there was a barn in part two as well.
Because the girl is, she at the very end, you know, he jumps through the window. Huh. And then the machete, I think, is sitting with the mom's head. And then she picks up the machete, hits him in the neck.
Okay.
And then that's when he falls dead. And then we see the beginning of part three is he picks the machete up and kind of like drags himself away.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. I need to rewatch these movies again. Jesus. I think there's about to be another Friday the 13th coming up next month or two or something coming up. So good reason always to watch Friday the 13th movies, you know?
And there's a, you know, speaking of writers, there's a ton of different writers on those movies. And that's something that I think is very difficult, that I think that these horror films don't get a lot of praise for. They're just looked at as dumb horror movies. Is how do you keep a series going that long with being fresh and original? Is that you have to have good writers make them fresh and original to bring people back.
Yeah. One of my least favorite movies of that. And I kind of feel bad because I know the director is out on Facebook and he's making a documentary about it. I'm sure you know which one I'm talking about right now then. On part nine, Jason Goes to Hell, which, I mean, I remember watching it on TV and liking it as sort of, you know, like at least liking the idea of the body switch thing, because I've always been a big fan of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. But I just felt like it was odd, you know, like it was just like
it's a different film. I'll tell you a little story. So when I was, this is a long, long time ago. This is 2000, actually. I went to the Sundance Film Festival. And but right before that, when Jason Goes to Hell came out, my friends and I went to the Fangoria convention. Adam Marcus and Decane Hodder were there showing scenes from the new movie, including showing uncut scenes from the previous movies.
Oh, wow.
And this is all shot, this is all on film at the time.
Nice.
And so we're really psyched to see the movie. And then I went to Sundance in 2000, and Adam was there with a film called Snow Days, which was later turned, they changed the title to Let It Snow.
Yeah.
And he invited everybody back to his place for the after party. So I went, and I started hitting on a woman that was at the party. Nice. It ended up being his wife.
Oops.
Yes. And we started talking, and we both, you know, I was from Pasadena, he's in LA, and for roughly 5 years, and Adam Marcus was my mentor.
Oh, that's
and
nice.
I would hang out with him, and I'd go to his house, and he would loan me, because the only things that were available at the time were VHS recorders, and I was taking at Los Angeles City College, directing courses, acting courses, and he would loan me his VHS camera. And I would go film these little shorts that I still have. And so for a long time, for those 5 years, he was the guy that that I looked up to and who mentored me. And I don't know. He's at the end of Axmas in the special thanks, as I've thanked everybody up to that point who helped me get to that point. And he's one of them.
That's nice.
Adam's a really nice guy. He's a really great guy. And he has a lot of stories to tell about Jason Goes to Hell. And,
I can't wait for that documentary, honestly. My friend Allie was working on that with him. And I've had her on my show a bunch of times. And I absolutely, I can't wait. Like, I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And like
it should be. And that's the one thing about Adam is that I will say this is, because this goes back to the whole writing thing, is I would send him outlines or treatments or short scripts. I think he hated every single one, right? Except for like one. And at the time I was like, that's mean. But when I look back on it, you know, like years later, it's like, it was really helpful because he was being upfront and he was being honest.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things that I liked about him is I would know if I sent him something, he was either going to hate it or like it. And a lot of the times he hated it. And when I look back at those scripts, the ones that I could still find, they were bad. Right. I don't blame him. So it should be a really good documentary and I look forward to it. And the more people who can get honest opinions on your writing, the better. So
exactly. Honest opinions, not just saying, oh, I enjoy, like, that's the problem I have with, like, I can never get an actor one of my movies and expect them to give me an honest answer because a lot of them won't work, you know? So they'll say, yeah, this is great. Because they're expecting that even if it's bad, that they can do the best job that they can and still do, you know, and get work. You know what I mean? They're not going to look at my script and say, oh, that's terrible. Don't do that. You know, I like a lot of times. So you have to get people who you trust and you know are going to tell you the truth, you know. But, you know, sometimes the truth hurts. Like I've talked about this on, I think, on my podcast before and everything, but I had a guy who read one of my scripts, my first script I ever wrote, ever actually finished. I was so excited. It got up to page like 80 or whatever. Like that was as long as it was, right? And I was like, oh man, this is like, I'm gonna show this guy. I bet he's gonna love it. And he read, and he said he would give me notes on every page. It almost like every line had a note. You know, up to page 30, right? And then he said, I'm sorry, I can't, you know, I can't read anymore. This is so bad. My only advice to you is that you quit writing.
Excuse me. Wow.
Yeah. So, it hurt, man. I was never friends with that guy again. I hated the guy after that. Like, I had this like animosity toward him. And looking back at it, yeah, maybe the script probably was terrible, you know, right? Did I deserve to be told to never be able to write again? No. However,
no, that's not.
That's rude. However, because I would never say that to somebody, even if I didn't think that they were a good writer. Because I think everybody has a chance to improve. However, did it put a fire in me to keep going? Yeah, because I was like, fuck that guy. I'm gonna keep writing and everything like that because I know I'm better than that. You know what I mean? And it put me in a crossroads at that particular moment because I could have gone the other way and said, you know, well, I'm not gonna go into the film business because this is too harsh and I can't deal with this. You know. And I feel like writers should have a moment like that, you know, where they come to terms with whether or not they can handle it.
Well, you have to have a thick skin. You really do.
Actors too. I see a lot of people on Facebook complaining that the industry is too hard and they hate all the people in the industry. I'm like, then fucking change your people and continue going. Because if you're going to quit, you know, because if you can't handle it, you know, you can't handle it.
I mean, there's a point where a review, I think, is just too harsh. And, like, I got with Axemis, I saw that Brad Twigg was going to be doing Frames of Fear 2. And he was looking for short films. And so I didn't know Brad at all back then, and I hadn't made anything. And I sent him the script, and I said, if I made this, could you get it on Frames of Fear 2? And he responded with, if the film is as good as the script, you're going to be in part 2. And that was motivation.
Right.
To go out and make the best film that I possibly could. Now, if he had turned around and said, dude, this sucks, I would never put this on an anthology, just, you know, keep your day job, I probably would have never made the movie back then.
Wow. Like, you know, it's weird how we never thought about how, like, somebody's words can really affect us in the writing world. But then again, you have to look at the source that's telling you these things. That guy that said the stuff about me has never done anything like big or anything. Like, yeah, as far as I know, he's never written anything, you know? And on top of that, you know what's funny? Is he stole one of my ideas and put it into one of his books.
Wow.
And it's hilarious that, like, he stole one of my, like lines or whatever and put it into his book. And did I get mad at him for that? It was, I put it out there. That was my fault, you know? I'm still going to use it in my stuff, you know, eventually, because it's my, it's my thing, but.
Well, and that's the thing is you got to be really careful for writers. You know, Facebook is a great place to kind of throw an idea out on and see how people respond. But you also, I mean, I don't think this is true at all. I mean, it was just pure coincidence, but once the coronavirus was out there is I did make a joke saying, hey, I'm going to make a movie called Corona Zombie Virus. And I got something like 100 likes, and some people said, oh, too soon or whatever it is. And people thought it was funny. And then the next thing you know, like a month later, Full Moon comes out with Corona Zombies. And it's like, well, this is probably just a pure coincidence.
It might be also like, I think a lot of people have the same ideas all the time, you know, like I had an idea of something to do with Corona thing, you know, and then I put it out there and people are like, oh, I've heard the same exact thing from like 5 different people. You know what I mean? Like we can only have so many things that are, you know, ideas or whatever. And somebody's going to also probably come up with that idea as well somewhere, you know, like it's really tough.
But you just have to be careful. You just got to be really careful.
Yeah, you never know. Somebody may have saw that and said, you know, I like that idea. Let me go make that. And
well, I had a long time ago, I was working at Barnes & Noble. This is probably in the mid-90s. And once again, hadn't done anything. And a guy came up to the counter to buy some books. And he had a Star Trek, I think it was Deep Space Nine or maybe Star Trek Voyager hat on because the shows were both going. And I said, oh, do you work on the show or do you just own the hat? And he goes, oh, I work on the show. And so we, a couple days later, sat down and had coffee. And I threw 2 ideas out at him. 1 for Deep Space Nine, 1 for Voyager. The following season, both those ideas were on the show.
Oh, wow.
And they were to a T, what I told him.
Yeah. Well, that's why you just don't tell people your ideas. You know, you keep that shit to yourself because... You know, once they do that, unless you can get paid and get, you know, money from it. I remember watching, there's a TV show on Netflix called Love. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
But, I know of it.
Yeah, Judd Apatow produces it and stuff. And it's a wonderful fucking show. But there's like one bit where this guy gave, he's the main guy or whatever. And he plays this, He plays like the Judd Apatow's daughter in real life. She plays like this like bratty actress, and he's like her tutor. So he's on set for this movie called Wichita, or a TV show called Wichita. It's like supposed to be like Roswell, or you know, with like witches or whatever, you know, and stuff. So he goes and says, he like gives a script, like a spec script kind of thing to just as like, this is what I did, you know, whatever, to one of the writers. And he read it and he really liked the story, and they were running out of ideas of what to pitch. So the guy was in the meeting, the pitch meeting, and pitched that story out, and they're like, that's great. And then he goes, well, just so you know, Gus came up with that idea, right? And they're like, why did you have to tell us that? Now we got to pay him. You know,
right? Oh, no, there you go.
You know, now we have to do that, because if you don't say anything, you know, nobody knows. And oh, we didn't know, you know, right? But now that you've said that out loud, somebody overheard, and you know, like, it's all of a sudden now we have to actually pay him, and now he's got to be a writer on our show if we're going to, you know, and stuff. And trust me, like, that show is wonderful. If you want to see, like, the behind the scenes of what a TV show is like, I mean, I'm sure it's a little bit exaggerated, but, you know, because most shows are, you know, period or whatever. But, like, that was pretty good. It was, you know,
I'll have to check it out. I didn't know Judd Apatow worked on it. I had no idea.
Yeah, it's really good. I enjoy it, and I'll probably rewatch it again. The woman who played the it was so funny because the woman who played the character, the producer, she was actually at Scares That Care as a guest, and so I was talking to her about that, and she was like, "What?" You know, like, she was really happy that, like, I had seen that, and I'd seen her on Suits, you know, and stuff. Like, I was talking to her about,
oh, that's cool,
shows and stuff. And I mean, she's a wonderful actress and everything. That show's just check it out. It's really good. So to end this thing, I always like to ask my writers a couple things. Like, one thing I like to always ask is, do you have any writing habits? Like, do you like to write outside? Do you like to write inside? Do you like to do at night, during the day? Like, do you have a pattern? What do you like to do for your habits?
I work even with what's going on. I still work. So I'll normally come home, get settled, and then I'll try to get in something film wise. It could be editing, it could be whatever. But it's when I sit down to write, I will normally write at night. And I'll have a soundtrack that kind of matches what I'm writing playing in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And always start off with 12 questions. So, or not 12 questions, but just 12. I'll just go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and go up to 12. And that's my film. And so I'll just do one line on each thing. And then from that, it goes into an outline, which turns into a treatment. And then that goes into the script. So there is a process that I do for writing. So yeah. And I don't like writing. I'm not a big fan of writing with other people. So I tend to do it just myself.
So you just met Jackie, by the way.
Hi, Jackie.
I think she's, generally speaking, we do about an hour. So, you know, of the show. So she was like, wait, what's going on over here? Yeah. But thank you so much. Is there anything that you've been doing lately?
Just doing editing. So I'm working with currently with you know, with Todd with Screen Time Films to get those Axis 1 and 2 out there for people to buy, and then working with Brad Twigg on some stuff. Working a lot with Joe Lujan, who did the Immortal Wars and Rust series out here in Vegas. So Joe is awesome. And I keep telling him this, he probably thinks it's me just, you know, blowing, you know, air up his butt or something, but it's, I keep telling the guy he needs to be making, you know, MCU movies.
I like what he's doing. Like, I like him doing his own stuff right now. I think he's doing a great job. And
I think he's just on that same level, but just on a lower budget. So I can only imagine what he could do with, you know, a $60 million movie, exactly. You know, compared to $60,000 or something, you know?
Yeah.
Well, so it's.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Yeah. Yeah.
And there's some, and I'll end with this is I also have some short films that I'm going to be coming out, like 2 found footage ones, one called Cannibal, one called, If I Can't Have You, and then there's also Skull Evil, nice. Which is going to be coming out, which is gothic horror. So there's going to be stuff coming out. A lot of things are being reworked because of what's going on in the world right now. So I figured I might as well sit down and do that. So
do you have like a YouTube channel or anything?
I do, but there's really nothing on it. It's just I need to work on it more. So.
We got to get you some more content out there so we can, you know. So you can-
I know. It's odd that I actually have like 6 followers and I don't do anything on it. So for me, like 6 is like, wow, 6?
Yeah. When you're not doing anything, 6 is a lot, right?
I know. It's just like, wow, I have a video up there of me walking my cat, you know. So I guess 6 people have liked it.
Walk a cat?
Yeah, my old cat, when I moved out here to Vegas a long time ago, Max, he loved going on walks. So I put a harness on him and take him outside and walk him.
That's what my cat, Obi, I don't know if you've ever seen Obi's pictures or whatever. I sometimes post pictures of him. Now I'm in California. I don't have Obi, you know. But he would always walk with me and my dog, and we would go up to the park or whatever, and he would just follow us, you know. We didn't have a leash on him or a harness on him. I never felt like you should harness a cat, you know, but, you know.
Oh, Boris is my current cat. Max was fine with it. He loved it. I would take it out and he would see it. He'd be like, meow, 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 because he knew that we were going for that walk. So it was very cool.
Well, thank you so much. And
well, thank you.
How can people reach you?
Primarily Facebook, just John Ward. You'll just see a guy sticking his finger out at you. Okay. In the picture there. So it's, that's primarily it. So I'm also on Instagram and Twitter, but I don't use those as much.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. And I really, really happy that you're here and able to, come on the show and talk to us about everything that you're doing, dude.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate you having me on. I really do. So,
yeah. And we'll, definitely talk later.
So have a good one. Sounds good. You too.
All right. Bye.